Please turn to page 1081, and we're reading John chapter 11, verses 1 to 45. So that's page 1081. Chapter 11, and starting at verse 1. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, The illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, The teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, See how he loved him. But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odour, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always heard me. But I said this on account of people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him.
John, thanks for reading. And let me add my welcome to Charlie. It's great to see you. My name's Kev. As Charlie said, I'm the minister of Euston Church. We're really glad that you've found us. And thank you so much if you're someone who was part of this survey, if you answered our question. Some people got asked the survey question out in the square there. I know some people emailed in answers, and some people handed them in as well. We've got lots of great ones. It's given us, I think, lots of fuel to do a few of these evenings over the next year or so. So I hope we'll have your particular question addressed at some point. There were some great ones. Thank you to the person whose question for God was, are there any affordable houses in the Angel area? I think no is the answer. Come and live on the Caledonian Road with me. That's the solution there. And thanks for this emailed one. God, who would win in a fight? You, Allah, Buddha, Ganesh, or Alex Reed? I think, is he the one that's married to Jordan, the kickboxer bloke? I think she'd probably be a better bet in a fight than him. But anyway, thank you for that. Lots of really great questions. We probably won't have an evening on those ones, I'm afraid, but we will on some of the others. The biggest chunk of questions, though, were on the suffering issue. And on Friday, I was walking, we're just waiting for someone at Russell Square Station there. I got chatting to one of the charity collectors. She was collecting for the NSPCC. And she told me that they reckon in a classroom of 30 children, four people will be facing some kind of abuse at home. Apparently one child in the UK dies every 10 days related to abuse from a parent or carer. And they reckon that Childline get as many as 4,000 phone calls every single day. And I guess some of that probably comes from stuff going on behind the doors of the houses and flats around here. Just behind Russell Square Station there is the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery. I only know that because last year I went there a few times to visit a friend my age who'd had a stroke. I didn't know you could have a stroke this young, but he was there learning to speak and to walk again from scratch. The next street back is Great Ormond Street Hospital. You've heard of that one. That's the main centre in the UK for child heart and brain surgery. And a few streets over that way, just a couple of streets that way, is Tavistock Square, which that was the place where the bus blew up in the London terror bombings in 2005. Charlie and I knew one of the guys who died on the bus that day. He was about our age as well. So even in the middle of a young, healthy, prosperous city, things still scream at us, don't they? That this is a broken world. And actually, we don't even need to go out the front door to see that, do we? Because lots of us will know from our family situations, from our own bodies, from our own hearts, the pain of a broken world. And I should say at the start, I speak as someone who lives in this broken world, as we all do, but very conscious that some of you will know a lot more about what suffering means than I do. One person I had this conversation with was a little six-year-old lad. His mum was a friend of my mum and dad's. I was at home for the weekend and they were around. And he's a bit of a Star Wars fan like me, so we sort of bonded over that issue. But this little lad has no dad. The person in his life who should have become a father figure was an older brother who a few years ago was horribly brain damaged in horrible circumstances. He now lives permanently in a home. And the little lad himself, he has a kind of speech problem thing that makes life painful and embarrassing for him at school. And he was asking why God doesn't seem to answer lots of his prayers. And the main issue there is not how do you start to explain this to a six-year-old, is it? The main issue is how do we begin explaining this to any of us? These are hard questions in every sense, and we have to say at the start, we'll never get to the bottom of them in the whole of our lives, never mind in half an hour. But the great thing is that the Bible does have things to say. We've actually just started studying through John's Gospel that reading came from on Wednesday evenings. And John's big starting point that we've seen in the last couple of weeks is that Jesus is God. If you came with a friend who's been at those studies, ask them more about that while it's still fresh in their mind. It's something that you'd want to ask questions of. But what that means is that if John can show us stuff about Jesus and his response to suffering, then that would tell us directly about God and suffering. And so keep that reading open. Thanks for listening through what was a long reading. Thanks to John for reading it for us so well. John chapter 11 that we just read there is really the day that Jesus was asked the why question. I don't know if you saw it, the why question kind of came up really three times in those verses. So this man Lazarus dies, and his sister Martha says to Jesus in verse 21, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary, the other sister, she meets Jesus in verse 32. "Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died.'" And maybe you think it's just remorse with them, but there's certainly a real accusation by the time we get to verse 37 in the crowd. "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Jesus could have stopped this thing, couldn't he? So why didn't he? And why doesn't he stop all the suffering? That is our question. And I put some headings on the sheet there. If you've got the insert there, you'll see three points for where we're going to go in the next few minutes before questions. And the first is that it's not that God is unloving. I think we can see that really clearly, can't we, from the way that Jesus feels about this family. These people were close friends of his. It keeps going on about the fact that Jesus loved them. And when Jesus finally arrives 4 days too late, his job is not to be the stiff upper lip in the room. So look at verse 33. "When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who'd come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled." Just down in verse 35, on the way to the graveyard, Jesus wept. And again, when he arrives at the tomb, verse 38, "Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb." And it's actually a very English translation, this phrase, "deeply moved." "I am deeply moved that you are dead." You kind of have to be the most British person in the world to say it. It's actually a phrase that's to do with being angry. It's apparently, it was used of war horses going into battle, kind of snorting and shaking, you know, when you sort of see the steam coming out of the nostrils. That is more the scene here. I remember the first time I saw my dad cry, and that feeling like quite an unsettling thing. Well, how do you feel about this picture of Jesus in this scene? Bloodshot eyes, probably. Snotty-nosed. Loudly distressed, he is. And that's surprising in lots of ways, isn't it? You might expect Jesus to be like the person in the room who's already seen the film that we're all watching. So the plot twists and the emotional highs and lows don't affect him in the same way, because he knows what's coming at the end and that it'll all be okay. There's more to be said here by a long way, but this is certainly not a God who is detached, is it, in the face of human suffering. This is clearly not a religion that says pain's an illusion or pretend it's okay. This is not a Jesus who thinks death is a natural thing in the universe. Now, when God comes face to face with broken hearts and broken bodies in his world, he is gutted. He weeps with us in our pain. And he shares our sense of outrage that this isn't the way things are supposed to be. And actually, it's the fact that God is like that at all that creates the issue behind our question. Because if we could just say, well, God doesn't care, well, there's your answer, isn't it? But if God cries with us in our pain, well, then that's where the question really bites. Why doesn't he always end it? And that leads us to our second heading. And I think this is the hardest part of our answer. Hard hard for us to understand. I don't claim that I've got my head around this at all, totally. And hard for us emotionally, I think, when we see what this is saying. But the second point is that it's not that God is powerless to help. And I think sometimes people have so emphasized the fact that God grieves with us that it's kind of pushed them in the direction of saying, well, it must be that God's hands are kind of tied behind his back in the face of human suffering. Because if he does exist and he does care, then surely he would end it if he was powerful too. It must be that these things are somehow out of his control. Well, that isn't it, the Bible picture of God. Things are never out of God's control. And that is really clear here again, isn't it? Jesus' hands certainly weren't tied. He could have intervened to cure Lazarus at any moment, straight away. He cured lifelong blindness just two chapters ago. And he's going to show even more power than that before this chapter's out. But look at what he does in verse 5. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Jesus waits deliberately and lets Lazarus die. And we Christians need to be honest about our God and what we believe about him. We mustn't try and get God off the hook by saying that he's sort of somehow trapped in the journey of pain with us and can't do anything about it. God is always in control. He could intervene at any moment to end any suffering, just as Jesus could here. And we see Jesus doing that. Jesus, elsewhere in John's Gospel, ends suffering everywhere he goes. And yet sometimes God waits deliberately and chooses not to. And this isn't saying that God causes suffering in that way. We could have a whole talk on the causes of suffering. And interestingly, the Bible's very clear, actually, that the finger of blame points back in our direction when it comes to the reasons why pain and death are in the world. Now, Jesus didn't kill Lazarus. He's not responsible for his death in that way. But we do need to face the fact that for some reason he doesn't stop it either. And actually, the more you believe about God, I think this becomes more of an acute issue. So my mum had breast cancer a few years ago. Lots of people prayed. She had treatment. And she got better, thank the Lord. My friend's mum had cancer. Lots of people prayed. She had treatment. And she died. And in this case, we do get told the reason why Jesus doesn't intervene in this case. So look at verse 14. And this is quite shocking, I think. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad that I wasn't there, so that you may believe." It's quite a thing to say, isn't it? I'm glad I wasn't there. Now, we know he's not glad about the suffering. We know that from the way we've seen him feel when he does get there. But Jesus is glad because the end result of this will be more people believing in him. And I'm conscious that could just sound very callous, that Jesus thinks that that end result, more people believing in him, would make this family's suffering worth it. But it is what happens. So by verse 45, more people have believed in Jesus. And the reason that matters in John is that John's Gospel makes it really clear that believing in Jesus turns out to be the most important thing in the world. Your whole eternity hinges on whether you believe in Jesus. And so Jesus cares hugely about that. Jesus cares about getting people to that belief. And so he's glad of the chance to give them a proof that will help them to believe it a bit more. That is the reason that Jesus doesn't end the suffering sooner in this case. And this is where we need to be careful and say there are some things, obviously, that are unique here, aren't they? So we don't always get told God's exact reasons for why he doesn't end the suffering in lots of other cases. But the Bible does tell us to expect that good will come out of lots of painful situations. Doug spoke to us a little bit about that. And the Bible talks about the fact that suffering can sort of wake people up to what is really important in the universe. I certainly know people who that has been the case for them. It says as well that hard times can be one of the things that helps people to become more like Jesus. But we do need to be so careful, because even though God may have a good ultimate purpose in a suffering situation, we can't always see that. We don't always know what it is, because we live in the middle of the story. And that's really the hard thing, isn't it? When you live in the middle of the story, you can't see how the thing's going to pan out. And in the middle of the story, it can just be very difficult, I think, in lots of situations, to see how anything good could come out of them. Think of the Holocaust. You know, why did God allow that? Who knows? And I think we need to be careful, too, of just sounding trite with this sort of thing. So good will come out of this, don't worry, is not the first thing to say to someone who's really going through the mill. Though actually, often, having spoken to a few Christians who've really gone through deep, horrible suffering, actually often it is them who want to talk later on down the line about how they were able to look back and see that God had brought good out of something dreadful. As I say, hard for us to understand, hard for us to accept emotionally, but I think it can help us to trust God on this one if we think about Jesus on the cross, which happens at the end of John's Gospel, and see that being in control, but allowing that painful situation to go on, that was a very painful thing for God personally, to let that happen. The Son who he loved more than anything, dying in agony, God the Father could have intervened at any moment to stop it. And yet he didn't, deliberately, because of the good that would come out of that. God the Son, Jesus, on the cross, he could have stopped his own suffering at any moment. And yet he didn't, deliberately, because of the good that would flow to you and me, actually, by him staying there and dying. God knows from bitter personal experience how painful it is for him to be in control and yet not always intervene to end suffering. And actually, it's a great truth that God is in complete control. We mustn't be embarrassed about it, because it's the fact that God is in control that means that we can trust that this third point is true. And that is that God will stop the suffering. That is the great message of the Bible. He loves us enough. He's in control enough. And God has put a day in his diary when he will end all the pain. And Jesus gives us a glimpse of what that day will be like here in verse 39. They think he's crazy. Jesus is kind of on this march towards the tomb. They think he's going to really honk badly. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. But Jesus is kind of in the warpath as he arrives there. So he prays, and then he shouts loudly, "Lazarus, come out!" I help to lead Christian camps for teenagers, and sometimes my job is to wake up the student lads in the morning who have to make the breakfast for everyone. I do it in a louder voice than that, and sometimes with less success than Jesus has with a dead bloke. It's amazing. So verse 44, the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. It's a bit undignified. You kind of wish Lazarus would come out with the kind of smoke around him waving to the crowds. He has to bounce out because his feet are tied up, and he's got a dishcloth on his head. So it's not the most glamorous scene. But he's alive is the important thing. Just 3 words from Jesus, and the whole scene has been completely transformed. And that is really just a tiny glimpse of what Jesus will do on the day that Martha talks about back in verse 24, the last day, the day on which Jesus' war on death and suffering will be won forever. Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and I am the life." It's interesting, isn't it, to think what we mean when we say that God should stop all the suffering. What would that involve in practice if God was going to do that right now and end all the pain? Well, I guess the first thing God would have to stop would be us, wouldn't it? He'd have to stop us, change us from the way that we hurt each other and the way that we cause so much of the pain in the world. Interestingly, chatting to this woman who was the charity collector for the NSPCC, I told her kind of why I was asking, and asked her what she thought about God and children suffering and all of that. And she thought for a minute, and then she said, "Actually, it's not God that's the problem here, is it? It's people who are doing this." And she was bang on. We are the ones who cause most of the suffering in the world to each other. So God would have to change us if he was going to end all the problems. Stopping the suffering would also mean finding cures to all the diseases. It would mean reversing death, wouldn't it? And it would also mean sort of having to rewire the whole planet so that things like tsunamis wouldn't be able to do any damage. Stopping all the suffering would mean ending this world, wouldn't it? It would mean starting again with a completely new world, with a new kind of people who have hearts that don't cause pain to each other and in bodies that will live forever. And that is exactly what Jesus promises to do on the last day. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Imagine it after this body that you're in right now dies, living in a body that will live forever. It's amazing to think about, isn't it? And if it sounds like sort of dreamland, then raising a dead man to life, as Jesus has done here, that is a pretty good visual aid that shows that that is the kind of business that Jesus is in, isn't it? He can deliver the goods. And we need to say again, believing these promises doesn't necessarily dull the pain when you live in the middle of the story. Jesus talks confidently about eternal life here before he then goes to Lazarus' tomb and weeps like a baby. But this is the difference between grieving with hope and grieving with no hope. So just think of the things in this passage that you will never see again if you have eternal life on the last day. No more need to be consoled. Childline will be out of business. No more weeping. Some people can't stop crying. The things they've been through are so horrific. What a relief for them on that day. No sudden message about a loved one that shakes you up in all the wrong ways. No stockpile of linen and burial cloths and whatever else Lazarus was dressed up in. No tombstones anymore. It's almost too much to imagine, isn't it? Can it really be true? Do you believe this? That is the question Jesus, that's his big question for us really, in verse 26 as he leaves us with this. Do you believe this? Feels a bit of an awkward question to ask a grieving family, but it's asked full of love by Jesus. He's concerned. He knows that believing him is the only thing that will put people on a path towards the life he's talking about. And he knows it's hard for people to believe. And so he's kindly organized the whole book, these John's Gospels that you've got in front of you. The whole reason that Jesus organized for this to be here is so that we can see his words, see him in action, in ways that will help us to believe that these things are true. And so do take that away. That's yours to keep. Get into John's Gospel. I hope you will. Or get into the Psalms, as Doug suggested. That would be a great thing to do. The Bible doesn't have all the answers neatly sewn up on these things. But my experience is that the words in here make sense of the world and these issues more than anything else. And they do offer real hope. And so the question is kind of, well, where else will we go if we turn away from Jesus? Cut God and Jesus out the picture. And the suffering questions become a whole lot worse. Will we blame God? Emotionally, that is understandable that we would want to do that. Or will we step towards it? He is the only person who could end our suffering, can end it, will end it. And he longs for us to know the person who promises to do that. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?